Okay, so I'll continue more or less in the same topic that Lenny was talking about. So he gave the more mathematically precise part of the talk. So I'll give the...
We're going to get nice pictures.
Yeah, we'll get some pictures. I'm not sure if they're nice, but... yeah, so I'll give some ideas on how this could work. It will be more speculative. But let me start with some generalities. So we have these two descriptions of black holes, one from infinity, where we know through AdS-CFT and so on, we know what the microstates are. And we have, on the other hand, the description from the falling observer. And I think we should not give up on any of the two. We should make them consistent, and that's the challenge. And it would probably require all the ideas that are being discussed. I mean, there are many proposals, and probably all of them will be important for understanding how to make them consistent. I mean, in general, when we had problems with dualities, it was not that the duality was wrong, typically, but it was that our understanding of the duality was wrong. The question is whether gravity results from some approximation, and perhaps this approximation sacrifices unitarity. And there is one historical example which is, I think, very similar to what we have here, which is the Boltzmann equation. So it's an equation which apparently describes what's going on in a gas, and it's irreversible, and entropy increases. And so that's the H theorem. And microscopic, so H is for horizon, that the area increases. And microscopically, we have time reversibility. And this historically led to some paradoxes. And it has a famous name, Lockschmidt paradox, the idea that these two descriptions seem to be incompatible. But we now understand better where we're putting in the time irreversibility when we put in the statistical description. So we should probably, our situation here is somewhat similar to this. And recall that hydrodynamics works well for black holes. So this is a particular case of, we have from the boundary description, it looks like gravity should be like the Boltzmann equation, perhaps, or something similar. It should be the quantum Boltzmann equation for strongly interacting systems. And if we understand this properly, maybe we'll find this phenomenon of interior even in other more ordinary system, whatever it is. In some sense, this black hole problem is similar to other mesoscopic physics problems because we have both the statistical mechanics description and deterministic. But the new feature is the presence of a pure state, this pure state inside the horizon. So we have understood various features of the emergence of spacetime from the gauge theory. And some of these features are similar to what's understood through the renormalization group flow. In particular, if we have the ground state of field theories, so empty ADS, for example, we have the usual Wilsonian renormalization group picture, and that different radial directions correspond to different scales in the field theory. And that's fairly well understood. Now, I would like to review some things that condensed matter theorists did to understand a little better this Wilsonian description of the ground states. And I think because they have a lot of similarity to how the geometry emerges, and I'll discuss some of the similarities. This goes by the name of tensor networks. And the simplest example is if you consider a spin chain, so we have spins plus or minus a half, and there is some Hamiltonian, and we're trying to describe the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And so we can, so the objective is to find the wave function as a function of all the spins. And one can make an ansatz for the wave function in terms of a trace of a bunch of tensors, n tensors. These are d times d dimensional matrices, and for each side we have two such matrices corresponding to the spin plus a half or minus a half. And we take the product, so we contract all the indices of these tensors, and we'll get a number that will depend on all the spins. So that's one possibility. The tensors could be all different, or they could all be the same. So all for all sides, we could have the same two tensors, for example. So if the system is translation invariant, then we'll have the same tensor for all of them. We expect to have a wave function which is translation invariant, the same tensor everywhere. And that gives us a wave function. So it's a way of constructing a particular wave function. And what is found is that this representation works pretty well. It describes well ground states of systems if the system has a mass gap. So it describes well wave functions where the entanglement entropy, basically the important property is that the entanglement entropy is finite. So if you divide the system into two, you have a finite amount of entanglement between the two sides. And as long as the dimension, as the dimension of the tensors or the number of indices is big enough, one gets a good accurate description. And people have done this numerically, and they've understood that they managed to get very nice results using these methods. Notice that the dimension of the Hilbert space of this system is 2 to the L. L is the number of spins that we have in this closed chain. The dimension of the space of tensors is L times d squared, right? So that's the number of parameters we have in this ansatz for the wave function. And so we're exploring a subspace of the Hilbert space. This is some particular subspace of the Hilbert space of the original system. Now, of course, here we constructed a particular wave function. We could, for example, change the tensors. And as we change the tensor, we span various wave functions. And then we can take linear combinations of those wave functions. And if we start now taking linear combinations of those wave functions written in that particular way, we have the superposition of those tensor networks, and that would be something of much higher dimension. And that's bigger than the original dimension, so there is some redundancy in this description. So you could either, so you are representing superpositions in terms of enlarging the amount of indices in the tensor. Okay. So in such a way that you consider just that one single wave function written in this way. Now that was done for.
I'm sorry, can you say one more time what the tensors are?
Yeah. So the tensors, so for a given problem, so imagine you had a particular spin chain and you are studying the ground state, then you would find the tensors are concrete d by d dimensional matrices. You have two of them, one for spin up and one for spin down, and you would find them numerically. So this is what people do. Yeah. And they are chosen in such a way that the wave function written in that particular way is the ground state of your particular Hamiltonian. It's annihilated by a Hamiltonian. Right? So it's a representation of the wave function in terms of these particular tensors. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, this is very important. Yeah. No. You might not know, and you might. People solve numerically for these ground states. It's a variational ansatz. Yeah. Yeah. So that is known. That will work. That will not work for all systems. That will work as long as the entanglement entropy is less than is obeys this relationship. So this is the entanglement entropy when you cut the system into two pieces. If as long as that's small, then compared to the dimension of the tensors, then it will work. No. If S entanglement is proportional to L, then it won't work. No, then it won't work. So S entanglement, S entanglement is a property of the system you want to describe. Okay, it's fixed. Forget about D, about the tensor networks. It's a physically relevant thing. You calculate it, gives you a number. And then you want someone tells you, I have a system which has some entanglement entropy. Find the wave function for me, right?
And
No, it's not. No. The point is that for this representation to work, it's not the function of L. So this will work for systems that have mass gap, for example.
L
is the length of a system, so it will work for those systems. And it will not work, for example, it will not work in a system that is conformal in the infrared or scale invariant in the infrared, then this will not work. Okay. Or it would work if you make D, proportional to L, but increasing with L, but it's not so convenient. Okay. So then what works in the case that you have scale invariant systems is this ansatz. It's called MERA. It's proposed by Vidal and others. In this ansatz, you have the tensors are a little more complicated. So the spins are here. So these are where the spins. Yeah, let me go back to the previous story, because now I'm going to. So this was the original representation. We are going to represent it in the following way. So we have the lines that come in from the bottom are the spins, okay, and each tensor will be an intersection between two lines, the line that comes in and the line that goes this way, and this line represents one of the indices of the tensor, and this the other index of the tensor. And a closed line represents a contraction of the two indices. Okay. So that's the story. So now this is similar, except that here we have a five-index tensor. Okay. So let's pick a bulk point here. So we have a five-index tensor. And some of the indices are contracted with the ones that are higher in the hierarchy, and some are contracted. So they are contracted in this particular pattern. You should think of these bottom lines as being the spins, okay? And then you you have all these tensors. This figure continues to the left, and it could continue infinitely into the interior. And that is supposed to give a good representation for systems that are scale invariant. Okay? So this is similar to the geometry of ADS, where each tensor is representing one patch of size radius of ADS. And somehow these indices, which are contracted, are representing the, let's say, all the sum over states that when you do a Rindler decomposition between left and right, you are summing over many states, and that's roughly what the one way to think about the index. So the index is not these indices and so on are all contracted, and they don't represent necessarily anything physical. There is all physical operators in the original theory will be written in terms of contractions with these three indices in the bottom, never with some index here in the middle. So the indices in the middle correspond roughly to their change or modified by local operators in the interior, which are not gauge invariant in the GR sense. And so that's where the analogy is.
One, where does the dimension of ADS come into that picture?
The dimension comes in the pattern. So this picture works for ADS3. So there's a one-dimensional boundary and then a higher dimensional bulk. And if you want to do it more, it's harder to draw, but you have instead of five indices, you would need more indices, but it can also be drawn. Yeah.
Do you know whether that works for higher dimensions?
I don't know whether numerical people did numerically, but at least intuitively, you feel that it should work.
Yeah.
The talk I heard this summer at Banaske said they don't know yet.
Yeah, this was done for this one-dimensional cases.
Yeah.
So I'm going to assume that something similar would work for higher dimensions. And I'm never going to draw the higher dimensional pictures. That's that story. Then there is this. So if we want to compute the entanglement between, so let's say we have this region in the boundary, and you want to compute the entanglement between this region and the rest, then before I continue, if you want to compute the entanglement in one of these situations, the entanglement cannot be, so let's say we cut some number of links here, right? Let me go back first to the picture, to this one here. So here, if we cut one of these links, the entanglement entropy cannot be bigger than log d, okay? So because there are d states here, and that's an actual bound for the entanglement. The actual entanglement of the system could be smaller, but it cannot be bigger than that. If these tensors are very generic and so on, then it will be of order d. Now, similarly here, the entanglement, so if we assume that each time we cut, we get something of order the number of indices we have, then our goal would be to minimize the number of indices we cut, and that will give you a surface which roughly has this shape, because if you go down here, for example, you are cutting all these indices, but these are, well, part of them are contracted here in this vertex, so they are represented short-range entanglement, so that should not be counted. Okay, so that, and this qualitatively agrees with this picture of Ruud Takayanagi, where you get to compute the area of the minimal surface in the bulk. Of course, here, well, I won't say more. Now, you can also use this to describe, imagine you had now a CFT, the same, the tensor network is not a property of the CFT, but it's a property of the state in the CFT. You're trying to represent particular states in the CFT. And so in particular, you can consider a state of the CFT that itself has a mass gap. So by a state that has a mass gap, I mean a state that has short-range correlations or short-range entanglement. An example of a state like this would be something like the following. Imagine you have ADS. This is the boundary of ADS. And at some point in the interior, let's focus on these slides first. At some point in the exterior, you have an end of the world brain. Okay, you have some brain there. ADS does not continue forever, but you have some brain. And if you let this brain evolve, then it will fall, and it will fall in, and it will create a horizon, and you'll have something which from the outside looks very much like a black hole that formed from a pure state. So let's look at this. At the state, at the tensor network that would represent such a state. Well, near the UV would be the same as one of these scale invariant networks, and in the infrared it will be similar to the type of networks we got for a mass gap, right? For theories with a mass gap. Yes. Yeah, this direction is the direction of space, right? I'm not representing time. I am not talking about time. This is a representation of the state at some particular time. Okay. And in a situation like this, one can actually make it this extremely precise and say exactly what state it is in the boundary theory and so on. And well, that boundary state, that state corresponds to a boundary state in the sense of D brains and so on, and will have this particular representation. So the idea is that if we want to recover bulk effective field theory, this is again a cartoon. The idea is that we would start with a given tensor network that represents the particular state that we have. That will be what we will call the ground state of the effective field theory. So in effective field theory, we need to start with a particular state, and then we describe small fluctuations around that particular state. And so the idea is that we start with a given tensor network, and that would correspond to the bulk vacuum, or the bulk state from which we are going to build our perturbation theory. And then we would find new states, which are small deformations of the tensor. So we have all these tensors all contracted. I wrote them here in a linear fashion, but as you saw, the contraction pattern could be a little more complicated. But you locally change one of these tensors a little bit, and that would be a localized excitation that will be localized in the bulk. Okay, but localizing the bulk just means localizing this space of tensors and in their construction. So there is no sense in which they are necessarily localized in the boundary. Okay. And this local non-gauge invariant degrees of freedom that we normally use to describe. So normally when we think about quantum field theory, we imagine that at each point in space there is, you know, there are some spins or these local degrees of freedom, and somehow those should correspond to these indices of the tensor. They are not observable, they are not visible. What is relevant is small fluctuations of the geometry. So now we go back to this situation, and we try to see what happens when we try to time evolve this. So far what I discussed roughly is time slice at t equal to zero. Now it doesn't make a lot of sense in GR to talk about time slice. I mean, if we have the wave function here, it should not correspond just to this time slice, but all the time slices that are related to it by Hamiltonian evolution. So we should draw a picture more like this, where we have some whole causal diamond that extends in this direction. And this was pointed out by many people, many of them in the audience, Joe and Marov, Hermsek, etc. But now what we'll do a time evolution of this system, and the claim is that the time evolution should be well represented by a network which now will have one more step here. Now why do we say this? So the point is that so initially we had this state with a mass gap. And now we evolve for 1 unit of time. By 1 unit, I mean 1 by beta, by an amount of order beta, where beta was roughly the temperature of the black hole we will end up forming, or was a length scale which characterized the mass gap before. And this is just simply the action of the discretized Hamiltonian. Will generate something with no more complexity than this. So the additional entanglement that it will not. The action of the Hamiltonian by one step, it will not entangle something here with something very far away. Right? It will only entangle something with something nearby, and that can be well represented by one additional line. Yeah.
That looks like time evolution in the infrared.
Yes, this is exactly time evolution.
You might think
yeah. So yeah, that's right. So time evolution in the UV, the idea is that it leaves this wave function invariant. So we are thinking of these wave functions in the Schrödinger picture. So we'll have this was near the UV, this was the ground state of the system. So we do time evolution and it leaves the wave function the same. It didn't change anything in the wave function. Well, the disturbance, so it starts with something which, so original ADS extends to the left, but we are putting a brain here in the interior that cuts ADS at this position, right? And that was the original diagram that I drew couple of slides before. That was this diagram, right? Yeah, those are horizons. Oh, yes. So outside, yeah, that's right, sorry. Yeah, this is a black hole which is it's closely related to the eternal black hole. The only difference with the eternal black hole is that we're putting an end-of-the-world brain here, right? So outside, the metric is the same as the metric of an ordinary ADS black hole, or ADS black brain in this situation. That's answering your question? Okay, so we naively from the field theory, we get this picture. And so there seems to be a stretching of space here. So now that's in this tensor network description. Do we see anything like this in the geometry? Right.
So why did this line go straight up instead of
one? This one? Well, there are many ways of drawing them. I mean, you could draw them like around 45 degrees. In some later versions, I draw them. But the basic point here is that. You get there is the appearance of these extra horizontal lines that have the possibility of generating more and more entanglement as you move. When you cut here, when you cut the system here, right? Originally, the entanglement was bounded by the number of lines that you were cutting, right? And now we are having more and more lines that you can cut, right? So the entanglement that this type of tensor network can describe is bigger, okay? And here? This one? Oh, this one, yeah. Yeah. So the pattern doesn't continue necessarily. Well, we here there is no. So here we have some kind of constant number of states, and we don't expect to. Well, first of all, if we started to have these things with five vertices, we would start contracting this network. That would mean that the long distance entanglement again sort of goes down, right? When we cut, we will cut less and less lines. Okay.
Now,
we could put diagonals here. This doesn't change the structure here. So the important. Right, right. So indeed, it does appear to have this shift symmetry. So let me say what that essentially would be. First of all, we have the fact that now it turns out that this geometry is very similar to the geometry of the nice lysis of the black hole. So if you take the nice lysis as defined by Joe and Bob Wald, etc. You find some slices that basically stay at the constant radial position in the interior. So that's a particular time in the interior, and then they go out. And as time goes on the boundary, they get longer and longer. So there is stretching. So this is the stretching that generates the Hawking modes, that generates the information loss, etc. So this stretching is the same as this stretching that we are having here in this tensor network. So. Yes. This is time evolution, right? It's Schwarzschild time evolution. In the interior, that's right. In the interior, it's a space evolution. In this network, it's also space evolution because we are generating a longer and longer network that we used to describe states, right? And in fact, yeah.
Is the Einstein equation?
No, the Einstein equation.
So the
No, this is, again, that's why I said my talk was going to be a little more speculative. There is no Einstein equation. This is only some pictures, vague analogy, let's say, between this this tensor network method and geometry. And on the boundary, that's the boundary. The Hamiltonian as the time translations here on the boundary, right? So we are looking at the wave function of the whole quantum gravity theory at different points in time, right? So in quantum gravity, the wave function in principle is independent of time, but when you have a boundary, then it does depend on time, and that's the time evolution we are using. So without using the gravity side, this tensor picture just comes from the idea that here we have some effective Hamiltonian that is a kind of spin chain Hamiltonian, right? And we are just evolving. So this looks like the type of complexity in the wave function that we will get by doing ordinary time evolution with that Hamiltonian. Yeah, that's the boundary Hamiltonian. So this picture, the picture here is a picture that we expect from the boundary theory. So it's a picture that describes the type of states that is a variational ansatz for the wave function in the boundary theory. Some ansatz for the wave function in the boundary theory. We're talking about, let's say, the n equal to 4 theory. And so for the n equal to 4 theory, we expect a representation like this of the wave function with very high number of indices here. It's a representation that doesn't capture the full locality of ADS and so on. So I'm not answering Jim's question, so I don't know how Einstein equation comes in and so on. So that I don't know. Yeah, they are roughly ADS size, so everything of order ADS size gets lumped together in some big tensor. No, it doesn't bother. This structure is supposed to happen to occur for strongly coupled field theories as well as for weakly coupled ones. So in fact, the condensed matter people are interested precisely because it can describe strongly coupled theories. Well, I mean, if you have some Hamiltonian that doesn't do anything, right? It's Hamiltonian H equal to zero, then you don't need to add anything here, and you'll get something time independent, and everything would be fine. So this is the most complex thing that the Hamiltonian can do, right? So a complicated Hamiltonian would do this, but not something more complicated than this. Okay. So we're just going to assume that the Hamiltonian is as complicated as it could be, and so it will give us something like this. Yes.
I guess that would be just
well, there are many higher energy states. I don't know. So each.
But I can't answer. Like the bottom part is the same for all of
them? Oh, yeah. So the bottom part is the same. That's the vacuum near infinity.
Yeah.
And then it will differ in the interior. In the interior, it will differ. It could be. Yeah, if you only add a particle, let's say you add only a single particle, so that would be the formation of one of these tensors in the position where the particle is in ADS. That's the idea. Right, this is a description of the wave function. So if you change your parameters, it will change this wave function. It will do some change, which as you evolve in time, will move along this this network. Yeah.
So I understand that if both time evolution the correspond to looking for different networks like this to get the same state on the ground.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah. You do bulk evolution, you now have a new wave function. I don't know how to do the evolution of the network from the point of view of the network itself. Right? So here the idea is that you start at some time with one network. You go to the next time, you redraw the whole new network, and you find the new tensors. Okay, so something that is missing here that we have in gravity is some way of updating these tensors purely from the bulk point of view.
So even your texture on the right,
Ah, oh yeah, yeah. So the idea here is that this network describes the whole yellow region. Yes. You could also think about it like that. But the point of view, that could be. That's possible. But the point is that from what we expect is that once we give the field theory wave function on the right at that point, we know about the whole slice. So if once you have, let's say, the wave function for one of those slices, then all the other ones should give you the same wave function. That's the statement of the bulk representation symmetry, would be the statement that with all possible networks, you would get the same wave function.
The length of your nice slice is sort of fixed by the yellow triangle, right? And more or less independent of which slice
is used. Yeah. So here, actually, so the length of this blue slice, of course, if we choose the slice along the horizon, it would have length zero. So that length can be compared to the network as follows. So we can maybe I'll discuss that later. Okay. Well, maybe I'll discuss it right now. So if you cut it, if you cut the network here, you'll get some entanglement entropy, and this is a spatial direction. So I didn't draw the spatial direction here, but if you cut here, you can find this root Aganagi surface, and demanding that it's a minimal area fixes it to be roughly what I drew there. So fixes the radial position inside and gives it a non-zero length, and a length that has properties which agree with this network. Now, if you send some particle, if you send some particle from the boundary that fell in, you would expect there's some kind of perturbation here of the tensor network in this point. And as time evolves, you are evolving in time, and this gets to be deeper and deeper inside the network. Right? And so you can think of it as so here this was never out of causal contact, so it can always send you a signal. But also, if you think about this blue slice, well, it's something that which is inside. And a perturbation of the tensor. So the tensor was not what it was before you sent the particle. It's a new tensor which represents the presence, represents the fact that the wave function has changed to a new wave function.
I have another question.
Yes?
Really,
yes? No, it does affect, but there might be many ways of. We'll discuss long ones in a second.
But I should literally think of that dot and it's corresponding to something behind the horizon. It corresponds to a whole.
Yeah, it corresponds to the whole history. Yeah, the whole thing, and so somehow the black dot, the dot should represent everything. Yeah, or you can think of it as going inside also. Now one way to understand why this tensor network is reasonable to describe the field theory is to consider a simple example of a free field theory, where you start from you construct the state in the following way: you start from a D brain in Euclidean time, you evolve for some Euclidean time, right, and then you evolve in Lorentzian time. So that's something that creates that geometry we were discussing before, and there when on this D-brain, when you look at particles at t equal to zero, they had some common origin here near the brain, so their entanglement is completely local. But as time evolves, the particles just move away from each other, and that the entanglement between, let's say, this particle and then and its neighbor gets distributed over a bigger region, right? So then, if the pair originated in this point, it will be contained in this region, will not contribute to the entanglement between A and the outside, and if it is one like this, it will contribute. Okay. Anyway, so that's. Now you could start from a basis of some kind of localized unentangled state. So here, on each of these tensors, you can choose particular indices or contract them with particular states, and then if you evolve that, then you continue to get this a structure which was similar to what we discussed before. Okay. Now here is the story about long networks. So imagine we try to construct a wave function which is in a rather generic state of this energy. So one way to do it is to evolve it for a long time and keep sending stuff, right? So what type of network do we get? So we get some network where we have perturbations of the tensors at various locations. And this is a picture which is roughly agrees with what we expect the interior to be for such a situation. So we expect a spatial slice through the interior to roughly be something like this. So this is a way to produce a more generic state. And if you keep evolving this network and you evolve it for a very long time, as you were asking, at some point you can continue doing these perturbations, but you'll get the same state, right? If you keep the total energy fixed, it's redundant. So this description is redundant in the same way that when we talked about the tensor description, and if we talk about arbitrary superpositions of tensors, we'll get a redundant description. Okay. So it's intrinsically redundant, but it focuses on states that are close to the states you actually get by time evolution. Okay. Now that's the story for.
I didn't understand. Yeah. I didn't understand what the blue dots are.
The blue dots are a tensor which is different than the tensor that.
And these are representing fluctuates. These are representing.
These represent particles that you sent in. Yes.
Particles you sent in. Oh.
Yeah. Let me see. I had. I lost it. Sorry. Here. So you send in an extra particle.
Okay.
And it mm-hmm. changes the tensor at this position.
Right.
Now you can do exactly the same thing. How am I doing with time? Oh, I'm over time. So you can do exactly the same thing with a two-sided black hole. It's exactly the same story. You have similar contraction of tensors. So I won't repeat the whole story. Now, this would be the black hole at t equal to zero. The eternal black hole at t equal to zero, we have this pattern of entanglement. I hope it's clear now. And then when we time evolve it, we say that it is natural that this should be the network that should represent it. But we could also have said that, we just put something here more complex with a tensor here which has many more indices, so we could increase it this particular way. So there are many different ways of increasing it, and one of them seems to be more natural. Yeah, exactly. That represent the fact that the state is getting more and more entangled. Right.
What is the overcompleteness again in this picture?
The overcompleteness in this, so in this picture there is no overcompleteness. So we have this construction of tensors, and that represents one particular wave function, the wave function of the entangled black hole. Now we could start sending in particles, and you're trying to modify it, right? And that would amount to modifying each of these tensors. So that's analogous to putting particles in the interior of the black hole. And that would modify it, and it could modify it in an overcomplete way. But given one particular state, when you go to the next state, it's natural to put this extra. I mean, this seems to be the type of I'm pointing this out because there is a large similarity between these pictures and the gravity description. It is related. Well, let's say in an eternal ADS black hole, you could. You're not. I should hurry. Yeah. Okay. So we have. Let me. I started. Okay. It was supposed to be 40 minutes. Well, they told me the rule was the blackboard also, and I was even sent an email that was behind the horizon. Now I was going now to discuss go back to ER equal to EPR and discuss it. Well, discuss some questions that arose, and also some, also in light of what I was saying right now. Things we already said, but the philosophy is that the geometry is a way to codify or generate the entanglement between the two systems. So as the black hole forms, as you consider the eternal black hole, you have the two horizons which are touching each other. You have this very localized entanglement. And now, as time evolves, the two horizons separate from each other. And there is a whole interior geometry. So interior geometry is something that exists between the two horizons. So one important thing is that the interior is not the same as the left side or the right side. So in many of the discussions, I think there is a kind of confusion between the left side and the interior. So if you consider the right side as the actual black hole you're interested in, then one should not confuse the future interior with the left exterior. Okay. So, and when we say ER is equal to EPR, so the ER is it could be this ridge here, but also this region here in the interior, whose only job is to generate the entanglement, the right pattern of entanglement between the left modes and the right modes. But it is incorrect it would be incorrect to say that this region is either this or is that, right? So we're not going to say that the interior is the same as the left or the same as radiation. So when we have radiation, radiation is the left exterior, it's not the interior, okay? Now by doing complex operations, we can shrink this. So shrinking this is changing the entanglement pattern to get close to the qubits that are on the other side. Okay. Yeah. So let's. Yeah. So the idea is that. Yeah. So the region in between was this whole region, right? So here, we have the left would be this bottom part. Then we have this whole region in the middle. That's the region here. Okay. Presumably, yes. One thing I think it's what you can see before talking about the Hawking particles. Let me ask a question which is closely related, which is the entanglement between the modes outside the horizon and inside the horizon. And that I think is essentially the so if you cut along one of these lines, let's say you cut along here, right? So there is this index. So the fact that you've opened this index, right, that gives you some entanglement between some degrees of freedom, and it seems to be a lot, but it's between these localized degrees of freedom, which are not obviously physical. They become physical through in Hawking radiation situation, but they are not obviously physical in the GR sense. And these pictures have also this property. That, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not claiming this is the field theory description of the interior. I'm just saying this is similar. It's some vaguely similar. Hopefully there will be some. There is no time here. There's no clear time direction, and that is something that is missing from these pictures.
And
yes. Yeah, it changes. Yeah, it changes the wave function and it changes the pattern of entanglement. But the operator, what is an operator? So an operator here is something that changes one of these tensors. It's the operator of effective field theory changes the tensor. Doesn't have a very direct translation to the operators in the boundary. So when we try to answer questions like is A commutator with EC equal to zero or not, we have to keep in mind that the space where these operators are acting, the bulk operators, are these tensors. These operators are not defined on the boundary itself. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, we don't have the local. I mean, we don't have the structure that we have in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. We don't have a Wheeler-DeWitt equation or something similar. We don't have, let me say it in a different way. So we don't have clear locality in the bulk. This is locality within an ADS radius. But notice that the interior extends over many, many ADS radius, because radii. So this is a rough description and not. Yes. No, I agree. Yeah. So for example, if in a situation like this, if you want to compute the entanglement entropy between for a region that is, let's say, this size, well, it might be more convenient to consider a surface like this, right? So once you start having this square pattern, it's not convenient to take the surface and make it bigger in the interior. So that's how you can get this volume. Okay. Well, these are some remarks I wanted to make. Well, some of these I already made. Now, notice that to describe the interior is not enough. One thing is clear: is one black hole is not enough. We need both black holes. This was made by many people. And one other point is that this is not equal to saying that A is equal to RB. So saying A equal to RB is the same as saying that the left interior, the left exterior is the same as the interior. We're not saying this. What we are saying is less clear.
Are you denying but, that if more than half the radiation has come out, that A can be pretty well approximated by RB?
Yes. So, yes, yes. Yeah, so what I'm denying is the following. RB is the same as the left exterior, right? So we should not consider this this region here as equal to the left exterior, okay? Now, for example, so there is this operator people normally call A, or some people call A, which is called, it lives in here, right? Now, if we say this A acts on the, it's the same as some left exterior operator, right? Which in some sense, approximately, you might think about it that way. But it's not correct to think about it precisely this way. And one reason is the following. Imagine that there is some guy that falls in through here and acts with the A, okay? He goes in and some guy that falls in and then acts with this operator. Then he would be able to, if that operator was an operator that lived here, he would be able to send a signal outside. Right. And that's already in this case. I don't need to consider more complicated cases. Even in this case, he cannot send a signal to the outside. Right? It would be forbidden by causality. If this interpretation is correct, that having two entangled black holes, well, that this describes two entangled black holes that are very far from each other, by falling into one black hole, by sending something into one black hole, whatever you would send, you cannot send a signal to the guy who is outside the other black hole, right? So.
But it's still true that once you have the RB, that B could be there, you almost maximally.
B is maximally entangled with A.
B, yeah. Right, but B can be maximally entangled, almost maximally entangled with something strictly on the left side.
Yes.
But that's possible, so.
That is possible, yeah.
In other words, it's redundancy.
It's redundant.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, in this picture, I guess the idea, so by comparing it to these tensor networks, the what I'm trying to say is that this whole interior region seems to arise simply from trying to approximate better the state. It's something that gives us a good approximation to the state for most questions. Yeah, so this is, again, something I don't have anything to say about. Yeah, I don't know. Because we don't have, these pictures of the networks are good for distances bigger than the radius of ADS, right? So intrinsically, by the way we understand them today. And this is a distance comparable to the radius of ADS. So proper time to the singularity is comparable to the radius of ADS. So to answer this question, one would have to build something similar to these networks, but I mean, this business with the networks I'm talking about is similar to other pictures people have discussed of causal diamonds, et cetera.
Why doesn't that large time step make you worried about the significance of anything that you've said for the interior?
Yeah, that makes me worried. But the only evidence that we are doing something related to the interior is the fact that the entanglement entropy agrees with what is computed by the Ruta Kayanagi formula, which actually senses the interior directly. So, but yeah, you could say, well, this doesn't make any sense or whatever. But I think it's in some right direction. The proper thing. It's not. We don't know what it is, but.
We're talking about it doesn't go to horizon, right?
I mean, extremal surfaces don't go inside.
Yeah, that's when you consider a spatial section outside. Yeah. But if you were to. Yeah, if you consider time-dependent situations, for example, the Ruta Kayanagi surface can go into.
But then it's not a killing horizon, and the horizon is somehow.
Right. Well, I mean, one concrete situation is the one I was discussing of the brain that falls behind the horizon. The geometry is exactly the same as the geometry of the ordinary eternal black hole. But nevertheless, this geodesics can do this. Okay, let me give you a better example, perhaps more clear. So. You can consider an eternal black hole like this, but with an infinite spatial direction, right? And now you can divide your two systems into what's in front of the screen and what's behind of the screen, right? This is these are the two subsystems. And then in that situation, the Ruta Canaria surface will go from one side to the other, crossing the horizon. And then you evolve, and then you have these surfaces I was drawing before. I perhaps should have emphasized it. So this surface is one of those Ruta Canaria surfaces that is cutting the system into two parts. We needed this extra spatial slice to make this more clear. Right. Well, this point I've already made, that A cannot be an operator on the left side. So. Now let me discuss a couple of questions that were discussed before. I guess I should probably finish them. Maybe this will be discussed in Stanford talk, so I won't discuss it. One point is that not all entangled states, or even entangled states of black holes, have a smooth geometry. And this was pointed out in this paper, and was also pointed out to us by these people. And the reason is kind of fun. So if you consider such an entangled state of four very separated black holes, this is called the GHC state, for those who know what that is. Then you can form a particular combination, which is called something like triple mutual information, that in all cases where it's the entropy is given by Ruta Kayanagi is always less than zero. This was shown in a paper by Hayden Maloney and someone else, and Hedrick. And so in that situation, there cannot be a bridge like this connecting all four black holes that is smooth. So in this case, the bridgeness, even though the black holes are macroscopic, the bridge necessarily has to be quantum mechanical. Of course, this is a very special state. These are various statements. So I now come various statements about looking at the eternal black hole in different ways and understanding what it means to have this bridge. So one was, at t equal to zero, we have this region connecting the two. At bigger times, we have this other region. And the regions, these two regions are different. So different entangled states give you different spacetimes in the interior, okay? Different combinations of tensors in the tensor network, or here, different spacetimes. Even though the spacetimes are different, in some cases, these regions might be common to various spacetimes. The same story with the tensor networks. You might generate complicated entanglement by changing something deep inside, but the tensors in some region could be the same. Now here, this is one fun example. So imagine you take, in quantum field theory, you can consider the entangled state that describes the Minkowski vacuum in Rindler coordinates. And then you make a unitary transformation that all it does is it adds this little phase factor for each of the modes, right? So this is a state that, because you added this this little phase factor, becomes singular. It's a state that creates contains a singularity here, and it will be singular on Lycon, et cetera. So just this little phase, this little change, would make this state singular. Now this state, would be non-singular and would actually be equal to the Minkowski vacuum if we were to view it as a state quantized along these slices. So if we view it as a state that's not quantized along the spatial slice, but quantized along this other slice, then it would be perfectly non-singular. Okay. But if we are in Minkowski space, we had to say on which slice we're quantizing, and once we give the slice and we change the phase, then we have a problem. Now imagine. Now we go to the black hole case, and we have the standard eternal black hole state that's supposed to describe this region. And now we add these phases. Okay. So we have a given state, and we add some phases. Naively, if it was the same as in quantum field theory, we would conclude it's singular. But The way this works is it's not the same. So adding these faces is the same as would be the same as evolving this left side, and we would automatically have this. Or equivalently, it's the same as considering this other geometry. So geometry inside adjusts automatically to be whatever it needs to be in order to be non-singular. Well, in this, I stretch it too much. Sorry. So this state and the state without the face are two possible entangled states of the system. Okay. One describes this geometry, and the other one describes this particular interior geometry. Okay. They are different, and in this particular case, they're both non-singular. Okay. So a geometry which would naively have been singular, a transformation which would have naively given us something singular if we interpreted purely in the field theory point of view, in the gravity point of view, what happens is the bridge changes in such a way that it's not not singular. Okay.
I have a detailed question. Sorry.
Well, I guess I could finish here. I made, I think, most of the comments I wanted to make. What?
Before the question period, I know people have stopped using the microphone, so I just wanted to experiment. And if they inhibit discussion too much, we won't use them. It doesn't seem to me that that they be able to anticipate your question by 5 seconds. I'm not going to be a microphone, please, but I'd like to see how he wanted to be here and his health has been coming. The reason I made sure he's a microphone is so that he can hear the question. He's listening to talk overnight. So please, put his phone right there for me. I should have called you that microphone.
Yes. Yeah, Daniel.
Can you say what was going to be on those last few slides you went through?
Well, I don't know how to get other states which are not the. I mean, you get other states by adding particles to the Hadley-Hawking vacuum. That's a simple way to get other states. One is not saying that all entangled states have the ER bridge that ER and R had. So different entangled states have different things that connect them. So the question is whether they are smooth or they are not smooth, and so on.
So in your gravity example,
yes,
you were saying that when you introduced this phase shift,
yes,
that you were introducing a singularity.
Now, in the field theory, we would introduce a singularity, not in gravity.
Well, sorry, I guess that was implicitly including in the bulk.
No, we don't. Yeah, no. The point was that we don't introduce. So if we do this transformation. So if we do this transformation, we do not introduce a singularity. That was the point.
Sorry.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to explain this again.
Yeah, can I just ask, if I take the state in the bulk that you've drawn on that slice on the right?
Yeah.
On the bottom right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I use the same state, but I quantize it on a horizontal slice.
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah,
there will be singularity.
No, it's still non-singular. So if you take this and that's a different slice in the bulk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can do this and quantize on some slice. I mean, the slice has to end here, but you can do that, and it's always non-singular.
No, I want it to stay on a fixed horizontal slice in the bulk.
In a fixed horizontal slice.
Yeah, and start with a vacuum, and then add some phases on the left, but keep it on that slice. Then I'm changing the state on that slice, right?
Right.
And then I'm introducing a singularity in the middle.
Yeah, no, no.
Well, yeah. No, we're not. I'm not changing the slice right now. I mean, I'm just introducing a singularity in the middle.
You see, what happens is that when you do this change, it's the same as changing the gluing that exists between the left time and the right time, right, through the interior, and that's why.
I'm not yet doing ADS-CFD. I'm just in the interior.
You're just in the interior.
I'm just in the interior. I'm just taking the left half of the interior and messing around with the state.
This may be a good place to make my point, which may answer Raphael's question. I don't. I think you may actually agree with what I'm saying.
Can I first formulate the question, though? I haven't gotten there.
Oh.
My question is whether that singular state can be represented in the double CFT. Because it seems like it can't, because you would always map it to a non-singular state on a different choice of slices.
Well, I don't know whether it can be represented. It's not something simple like this. So it's not just putting a face in here. I don't know how to represent it. Presumably something close to that singular state can be represented, but it's not. I don't see an easy way to say what it is in the CFT language. Maybe can be constructed, I don't know. It's not something as clear as it. So the point here was to show that some very particular states that naively would be singular from a field theory point of view are not singular in this context.
So you don't really mean that kink, right? I mean, because this is really
easier. Actually, let me, because I have the microphone, let me intervene. Yeah, this is the point I wanted to address, just to clarify for us and for, I think, everyone, that as I understand it, the left side of those two lines represent different operations, even in the bulk semi-classical limit. The bottom one is acting with the boundary Hamiltonian.
Yes.
The one on top is acting with the integral of the matter stress tensor against some vector field from the horizon outward.
Yes.
And if you use semi-classical bulk gravity to relate the two, mm-hmm. they're not equal. The gravitational Gauss's law relates the top one to the bottom one plus a boundary term on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And that boundary term on the horizon is, does, roughly speaking, what it does is it makes the kink you have on the left side. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line prescription in semi-classical gravity does exactly, if you like, take the top, tilt it, and quote, quantize it along the kinked surface. They're not separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you do a generic unitary transformation, maybe you need to use similar words. So this is a particular, so you say, so in your paper with AMPS, you said, if I do a unitary transformation on some of these states, on the left side, some arbitrary unitary transformation, I will generate a singularity. But maybe not. Maybe what happens is that you generate a new bulk.
Since you're talking to me, we didn't say quite those words. Well, we said if you did certain unitary transformations, you would generate excited states, which do still have semi-classical descriptions. They're just excited.
Okay. Yeah. So I have no complaint against excited. It could just be a different connection between the left side and the right side.
Although we then claim that those excited states were generic.
Yeah. Have you thought at all about the tensor network description of a typical state?
So I think what's important is what it is. So you can take a typical state. And it could be that the typical state has different construction, and one construction could be the one that I discussed. So I think it will be probably something like, let me see. This is a way to generate typical states. I think it will be something like this. So a very long network with changes at various locations.
Maybe sort of said what I was trying to say, but just I think you don't really mean the kink, right? Like when you do ADM, so if you just do some phase rotations, then you're moving one of those boundary points up without the other one, but I think you should just still connect them by some sort of smooth geometry, and then there's no boundary term that's generated. And that's fine. I mean, that still is enough to tell you that if you put in these phase rotations, that you get a state where the geometry is still smooth.
Yeah, the geometry is smooth. The geometry is the yellow piece. I mean, it's just a piece.
Yeah. The kink. Yeah, the yellow region is the only important thing. The kink is just a distraction, I think.
Yeah. Well, the kink was drawn there to. If it distracts you, it's just that it is similar. So this state is smooth, and if I were to quantize here on these slices, the state I would get this field theory problem, for which the correct Minkowski description is this particular state. So that's
it's more clear that
Yeah, I mean, it's clear from the picture that it's not. This was drawn simply to make the point that this is how the state looks like when quantized on those particular slices. Yeah.
I don't really understand if the yellow regions are described by Wheeler-DeWitt type
yes.
Wave functions. Then what exactly does a kink mean? A kink means that there's some extrinsic curvature at the kink. Is that right? Extrinsic curvature in the sense that
just for the description, I just chose a funny slice to.
No, I know. But I know what you did.
Yeah.
But if I want to add. Well, a Wheeler-DeWitt wave function contains every possible geometry that you could have
reduced
in there.
Right, exactly.
Right. It contains all the geometries.
Yeah.
And to say that a geometry has a kink in it, I think, is a statement about the derivatives of the metric in the perpendicular direction to the... it's a statement about the curvature of the slice.
Yeah. Right.
The curvature of the slice has to do with time derivatives, which means... canonical momenta,
yeah.
But if you write down what the wave function is, it just contains all such slices with all kinds of kinks in them.
Yeah.
So I don't understand.
Yeah,
right, I'm not.
What? Yeah, no, I'm...
Right.
Presumably another way of stating that is to choose the slice with the kink or another slice, they're just gauge equivalent, right? You can, the evolution operator that takes you from this slice to one that's smooth is a gauge transformation.
I mean, the intent of this was to show how the effect of a unitary transformation could be something simple. Now, this example perhaps is too trivial, and I think that's what Don was hinting at. I'm not giving you an example, more non-trivial example. So a more non-trivial example would be one in which we do a more generic unitary transformation, and what that would do is it would... So let's think about a more generic unitary transformation in the context of this tensor network, for example. So there, we would need to make a longer network. So it would, maybe there is still some network which is longer and nothing. And every site in the network is very close to what we would have for, let's say, the vacuum. And
yeah. Do you see any, just going back a little bit to the tensor networks, do you see any evidence for some connection between this redundancy in the tensor network description and the redundancy in your choice of slicing in the yellow region? Is that possible?
Well, the only thing is what Aaron already said, that you can choose different networks and that give you the same wave function. So indeed, the tensor network discussion has this redundancy built in it. Yeah. But I don't know how to translate them more directly. It would be nicer to give... we can discuss in private. There is one example where there is something close to this.
So, it seems like there's a close connection between these tensor networks and lattice quantum field theories. Like, I'm trying to figure out this connection. So if I started, for example, with a lattice Euclidean quantum field theory, where the degrees of freedom happen to be labeled on the edges of my lattice instead of the vertices, then am I right that that is a tensor network?
No, you are integrating over those degrees of freedom. So here in the tensor network...
Well, in a quantum field theory, you also sum over histories, which is the same as... the tensors would give you the amplitudes for any set of edges to meet at a node. So I think I think a Euclidean lattice quantum field theory with fields on the edges just is a tensor network.
Yes.
And that I guess the most general tensor network is like that, except the amplitudes can be complex instead of just real. Unless I'm not thinking about that right. But that means there's a close connection with things other people are doing in quantum field theory. So.
Why don't we move that to private discussion? We're now into cookie time, so I think we all have to get some fuel. But let's make one.